from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Mark Report. It's the second day of October 2008. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, the Senate has passed a heavily sweetened bailout deal, and the Secretary of Ag says it's a mistake to think the troubles on Wall Street cannot reach all the way to the farm. We'll have details of these and other stories shortly. At the end of this half hour, meteorologist Peter Levitt will join us to take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. It all happens on this Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of WILL Public Radio from the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at AgriGold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled in Chicago. On this Thursday afternoon, in the wheat pit, the nearby contract at $6.36, 33 and three quarters lower. March contract at $6.57 and three quarters, down 34 cents. In May, for the soft red, at $6.71 and three quarters, down 34 and a half cents. Kansas City hard red winter wheat settled the December contract 35 and a quarter lower, at $6.68 and three quarters. December corn futures $4.54, down 30 cents. March at $4.73, 30 lower. The May at $4.85, down 30, and July at $4.96, 29 and three quarters lower. November beans, $10.04, down 49. January at 10.20 and three quarters, 49 and three quarters lower. And the March soybeans, $10.35 and three quarters, down 50 and a quarter. May contract, $10.47, down 50 cents. October bean meal at $2.69.40, down $11.40. October bean oil at $42.71. down 149 at this hour. October live cattle futures, $95.70, $2.87.5 lower. December futures at $98.75, down $2.40. October feeders at $100.57.5, $2.97.5 lower. And the November at $100.60, down $3. October lean hog futures today, $65.95. settled down $1.77.5, and December futures at $61.40 a hundredweight, down $1.57.5. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like on the afternoon. Nearby November crude oil futures at $94.60 a barrel are now down $3.93. December futures at $93.65, down $4.27 for the afternoon. October ethanol, November ethanol at $1.98.2, down 11 tenths. November natural gas at $7.45, down 27 and 8 tenths. And the RBOB gasoline for the NOV at $2.25 and 2 tenths is down 10 and 7 tenths. November heating oil, that's diesel fuel, down 13 and 8 tenths of a cent at $2.70 and 8 tenths. And propane futures are trading the nearby November today at $1.42, 2 cents lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down just about 3% at 10,501. That amounts to 329 points lower. The U.S. dollar trading at 80.4 is down 0.76 on the afternoon. Gold futures at 829 are down 41.7 for the day. CRB index at 329.27 is down 13.97. Here's what the weather forecast with the two-state region looks like from our own Ed Keezer. He says tonight, in the north, it'll be mostly cloudy, a few scattered light showers. In central sections, partly to mostly cloudy. In the south, clear to partly cloudy. Lows generally will range between 40 and 45, around 50 near Lake Michigan tomorrow. In northern Indiana, northeastern Illinois, mostly cloudy, a few scattered sprinkles early, then partly sunny. Elsewhere, intervals of clouds and sunshine. Highs will range from 60 in the far north to 75 in the far southern parts of Illinois. Temps should trend upward. High Saturday will be in the 60s in the north to the 70s in the south. And high Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, mostly in the 70s and the 80s. You're listening to the Closing Market Report.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Thursday afternoon. Time to take a look at the agricultural commodity markets, and we're on hand this afternoon with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi, Todd.
Let's talk about what's happening. Maybe we should start in the outside markets where there is a loss in the Dow Jones today. And crude oil futures are down, well, $4.50 at this time.
Well, I think everything goes to the dollar. I think that's the leading indicator. I mean, that was the leading indicator as the commodity complex climbed higher the first half of this year. And I think it's been the leading indicator as the commodity complex has moved lower, basically, since the dollar turned up back in that June-July timeframe.
Yeah.
You've got the dollar in new highs for the year here, and I think that is just telling you that we're in a framework here that everybody wants this liquidation and run toward the dollar. And that is what we're seeing, I think, clear across the complex, whether it's someone that whether it's index funds that own ag commodities or oil futures or precious metals, they're wanting to liquidate, turn their inventory into cash. I think you look at the stock market, same thing. It's sell stocks that get the cash. So that is kind of, I think, basically the storyline as everybody has lost confidence. In the financial system, at least for right now, and I think everybody's wanting to move toward cash.
Well, if that's the case, then the dollar rallies, and sometimes we think that would be a good thing, but at this point, apparently not. Is that right?
Not for us, I guess, in ag commodities. It's everything. It depends upon which side of the fence you're on and what your position is. But, yeah, a stronger dollar is basically signaling that export demand is going to slow dramatically for the coming year. And it also is saying, I think, that we have a global economy that is going to slow. So it's basically the commodities are reflecting that, a slowing demand, recessionary type financial conditions worldwide. So that is what's basically taken on, you know, the negative impact of what we see here, corn, soybeans, crude oil, you name it. Just about every commodity in the world is down today.
Well, we're moving into new highs for the year, above 80, at least on my charts, mm-hmm. and they're delayed, but above 80 at this point. What do you see in the dollar for the coming months?
Well, dollars, currencies have a tendency to trend. Once the trend begins, they're a long trending type market. And if you look at your monthly charts and draw trend lines, we have broken above some major long-term downtrend lines. So it basically tells me that the dollar is in a strengthening mode now, and that's going to continue for some time. I think also what it's telling you is basically the European economy, as people move out of the euros, the euro has taken a real bath here recently, down sharply. Of course, you know, against the dollar, that is what's driving the dollar is that world currency traders feel that actually Europe may be in worse shape than we're in from an economic point of view, and that there's a lot of bad news yet to come out of Europe as far as bank failures and whatnot. So people are selling their euros and running toward the dollar right now.
Well, how do you view that then in terms of what's happening in the marketplace? And let's just take the export markets separately, now that you're within the confines of ADM Grain Group. Is there much of a lag, for instance, in exports in terms of last week's exports or the week before or whatever, we've had exports for both corn and soybeans falling off. Was that in a lag from the high prices, and can we expect then that that sort of changes out with now, I guess, we have a higher dollar, so it'll be continue to be hard to get to for those countries to buy corn and soybeans despite their weaker prices? The question is there a lag in the numbers that get reported for the export, and are those fall off because of the high prices, or are they pretty up to date?
No, those numbers are up to date. I mean, there is a federal requirement that any export sales, I forget what the number is, over a certain level has to be reported daily. So that is why we get, if you notice on the wire services, that there'll be a sale made to unknown destinations or something like that during the week. So any large sale is reported as in the daily reporting system. I mean, that's required by law. So the numbers that you get on your export sales, of course, they're a lag because they're always kind of a few days behind. But no, those are about as current as you can get within the framework. Now, some of the smaller sales don't have to be reported on a daily basis, but they get picked up. I mean, the small sales don't mean too much. It's always the bigger sales. But those export sales numbers are right on the money. Now, what they don't reflect, of course, is the intention of foreign buyers. I mean, maybe they haven't necessarily bought yet. But you have a general idea that XYZ country is in the market over the next 6 months for so many million tons of corn or so many tons of wheat. Those export sales don't necessarily reflect that. But once a sale is made, those sales numbers are public information.
Okay, so if the sales numbers are public information, and we know that's the case, and they're up to date, then if we're lagging well behind, that probably says something about the rest of the world and its ability to purchase grains and oil seeds. And I don't know whether it says that they were, from what your tone was earlier, I suppose it's not saying that they're so scared of the U.S. market, but they're scared of their own marketplace?
Yeah, everybody's slowing down. Economically, the world economy is slowing down. And then, of course, the other thing, too, is that world supplies have increased a little bit, too. Crops around the world have improved from where they were maybe 6 months ago, so it doesn't necessarily require the urgency to own inventory right away. But the market is fairly comfortable here now with the Northern Hemisphere, which is primarily here the U.S. Now, yes, we're arguing a little bit around the edges whether the national average yield's 150 or is it 152 or 153, but a crop is here. And it's being harvested. We're behind normal. But there is buy interest underneath the market. You know, end users are, this is the time of year that they sit back and they size up prices, they size up their inventory needs. There is some export pricing going on in this marketplace. But the main driving force is what we call long liquidation. From the index fund crowd or the speculative crowd, it's no longer to be fun being long, so they are liquidating those positions, and that generates more sell pressure than there is buy interest underneath the marketplace.
And so bottom line then, where do you think corn and bean prices might be headed at this point? Do you have downside and upside potential both?
Well, we have I did some technical work here the other day, to kind of pass around to people to kind of think, you know, what is the worst case scenario on technical downside price objectives. I think, you know, the first one right out of the chute here on corn is we're pretty close to it today after being down 30 cents. But mm-hmm. When I wrote the bees yesterday, we weren't down 30 cents. So, but you kind of got to look at this 450. Then there's a long-term chart gap. That was left on the December contract down in this 4.25, give or take a few pennies. It's about, 422 to 430 or something like that. So that's probably a downside target in the near term here for some chart people. So you get down into that. So I suppose, you know, another 30 cents, you're going to probably find a little support here in the corn market. Beans, we are at an even number here, even though we did dip below 10. We did manage to close above 10 today. If this 10 don't hold, then you're going to quickly look at $9.50 and $9 for downside price targets. But this market is terribly oversold in here. So I do think there's room here for this market to maybe try to find some consolidation anyway here. We'll see how harvest pressure goes.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens on a Thursday afternoon. Dave Dickey will be here in a moment with a look at today's agricultural news.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products, including Asgro's new Roundup Ready 2-yield soybeans. Lernard Seed Service provides services to help customers in East Central Illinois maximize profits. 217-497-2270.
In agricultural news, a $700 billion Wall Street bailout recovery plan loaded with sweeteners will be considered by the House tomorrow after passing in the Senate last night by a 75-24 vote. The Senate bill includes a $100 billion extension of tax credits, which could add about $65 billion to the federal deficit. On ag-related tax incentives, the bill would extend the $1 per gallon biodiesel production credit and the 10 cents a gallon small biodiesel producer credits to the end of next year. And it would retroactively eliminate controversial splash and dash practices that allow overseas biodiesel producers to collect the credit by docking at U.S. ports and adding U.S. diesel to their foreign production. The bill also extends the wind energy tax credit to the end of 2009 and creates a new biomass tax credit for generating electricity from waves or tides. USDA Secretary Ed Schaefer says it would be a mistake to think that tightening liquidity on Wall Street won't eventually hit the farm economy. Schaefer says the rising cost of farming and tightening credit could spell trouble for farmers preparing to plant next year's crops. Tight credit and high wheat prices is preventing some cattle producers from placing their cattle at feedlots or from grazing on wheat pastures. At some feedlots, deposit requirements have doubled to 40% of the cost. USDA says Congress has not authorized enough money to ensure packers and retailers are implementing country of origin labeling. Lawmakers have only provided $1 million targeted for the enforcement of the fish and shellfish program through next March. Agricultural Marketing and Regulatory Service officials say they need $9.6 million. USDA says it will use the existing $1 million to conduct enforcement throughout the entire program through March. USDA says it will give retailers 6 months to be in full compliance, but stores that do not begin to label immediately will be subject to prosecution. And hundreds of thousands of Americans will be newly eligible for food stamps or get higher benefits under new rules that went into effect yesterday. The new rules are part of the 2008 Farm Bill, which changed the name of the program to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The Bush administration says it is starting a public relations program to inform low-income Americans of the name change and changes in eligibility requirements. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming at WILL, public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week, reminding you to visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find this program and other agricultural programming you can listen to anytime you'd like as an MP3 file or sign up to have it delivered directly to your computer as a podcast. It's all at willag.org. Now, up next, the National Safety Council, of course, has been reminding farmers this month and ranchers to take care during the harvest season. I'll have more on the nation's most dangerous job and what the first person on the scene of a farm accident should not do.
Last year, there were some 80,000 farm-related injuries around the nation. Most of the time, these injuries involved machinery. Usually a hand or an arm, a foot or a leg was caught up in fast-moving tools. University of Illinois Extension Farm Safety Specialist Bob Heron says it's a common accident and one where it's best to leave the victim in place and wait for the first responders.
A lot of our extremity injuries, to the hands, arms, and legs that get caught in a piece of equipment or whatever. Normally, just from what happens, a person gets entangled in equipment, and from a first aid standpoint, if somebody comes on the scene, the mistake they often make is try to pull them out. They want to shut the equipment off, of course, if it isn't shut off, but often they should leave the victim in the machine unless there's some danger of fire or whatever, so that if and call for help for an emergency crew to come out that has training to deal with a person who's in that situation.
Once the victim is freed, Heron says they can quickly lose blood and go into shock. It's important for the first person on the scene to shut down and stabilize the equipment, call an emergency crew, and then wait for them to make a decision about how best to proceed with the extraction.
Another issue in farms this time of year is children. Now, we have a number of injuries with children because they come home from school, for example, or on weekends, and they want to be out where the excitement is, particularly boys, our research shows. And so they want to get out and they want to play, they want to be on the equipment, riding on the equipment. It all looks very exciting to them. But we need to realize that allowing children to ride on our equipment is putting them at significant risk because they can easily be thrown off the equipment because most of our equipment doesn't have any shock absorption in it, like a tractor, except in the operator's seat, and wagons and so on and so forth are very little. And it's very easy for them to be thrown off the equipment and be run over by the machine before we could stop it.
The lateness of the harvest season this year has a Heron particularly concerned about farm kids. He has no doubt the pressure to bring in the crop will cause moms and dads to ask too much of their offspring too soon.
This year could happen where we're getting a rush to get things done, and we start having our younger children, say they're 10, 11, 12-year-olds, operating tractors and doing different things in field work or moving wagons on roads or whatever it might be. They are very much at risk to accidents because one example is that they have very significant limitations. They may look like an adult and act to some degree like an adult, but they have one limitation is simultaneous motor skills. Where you have to move, if something goes wrong with the tractor, for example, it goes down in a ditch or whatever, and you've got to turn the steering wheel one direction, push in on the clutch with your foot, and maybe take an implement out of the field with a hydraulic system. You got to do that all at once to get the machine under control, and we don't develop our capacity as human beings to do that very well until we're between 13 and 15 or 16 years of age.
On the subject of kids, the younger ones will play in the gravity flow wagons. It's easy to get stuck, sucked down, and suffocated as those wagons empty. Don't let that happen. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In just 2 minutes, we'll talk with ag meteorologist Peter Levitt. And don't forget, it's a Harvest Hour edition. Stay tuned for the second half hour of the Closing Market Report.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Tom Rogers. Illinois election officials still don't know how they're going to remedy what a judge calls a misleading November 4th ballot. A Cook County judge ruled that language describing a vote on whether to convene a convention to write a new state constitution is misleading and inaccurate. Parties on both sides will meet tomorrow with the judge to determine the best way to fix the problem. It could mean mailing a notice to 7 million voters or posting it at polling places. Champaign County Clerk Mark Sheldon says he's stopped mailing out absentee ballots now, but he hopes the judge decides on a remedy that won't be challenged by a higher court. University of Illinois health officials believe they found all the people who had close contact with a student who's developed bacterial meningitis. They're not releasing the name, but they say the student is hospitalized and expected to recover. Meningitis is a contagious disease that affects the brain and spinal cord. It's known to be a problem in close contact situations like college campuses. Supporters of a sales tax referendum in Champaign County say it's not a perfect solution for school funding, but it would help individual districts meet their construction needs. A group of school and business leaders. Supporters of a sales tax referendum in Champaign County say it's not a perfect solution for school funding, but it would help individual districts meet their construction needs. A group of school and business leaders has organized a campaign for the sales tax increase, which voters will decide next month. The $17 million it's expected to raise each year would go to districts to build new schools, renovate old ones, or retire debt. They don't believe it'll affect ongoing efforts to change Illinois' method of funding schools, one that's heavily dependent on property taxes. An autopsy concludes the elderly man who died in a Danville house fire yesterday died of carbon monoxide inhalation. But Vermilion County Coroner Peggy Johnson is waiting on toxicology tests to determine for certain what caused the death of the man's wife. Lloyd White was pronounced dead at the hospital. His wife, Joanne, died at the scene. Both opponents and proponents of abortion say they've seen some success since Planned Parenthood opened a clinic in Aurora last year. Planned Parenthood of Illinois CEO Steve Trombley says demand for medical services is much greater than expected, but Pro-Life Action League spokesman Eric Scheidler says sidewalk counselors offering information have succeeded by sustaining protests for more than a year. I'm Tom Rogers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of WILL Public Radio. I'm Todd Gleason. On the line with us this afternoon to take up the agricultural weather forecast is Pete Levitt. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about the weather here in the Midwest.
Well, we have some brisk, very seasonal weather today. Temperatures hanging in the low to mid-60s from eastern Iowa right across Illinois into Indiana. Ahead of a weak cold front that's coming southward through northern Minnesota. So there's not much moisture with this system anywhere in the central or southern Midwest, maybe a few sprinkles up north and northeast. And as the front comes down, it'll just drift temperatures down a few degrees. Tomorrow will be kind of a cool day. And then we're going to go through a period as high pressure comes down across the Midwest during the next couple of days and heads off to the east of us, that temperatures will stabilize and then start to rise a little bit. And the big question in the forecast is whether the warmer air will return with any precipitation at all. For now, it looks like any such activity would probably be light and mostly confined to northern areas. There's not much moisture around. And the temperatures as we move into next week will actually average a little above normal. So all in all, when you look at this picture, it's a very pleasant weather picture, very seasonal, dry weather, very good for field work, and now maybe get some more of the late harvest completing here.
And no frost or season-ending freezes?
No. You know, the frost, even though we've seen a lot of cold air drop down through central Canada, it tails off. It sort of shifts to the east of us down through the northeastern states, and we're just not getting that big, fat, cold air mass. I think you might see something up in the lower spots of the upper Midwest today, but nowhere are we expecting any frost that wouldn't be pretty much along the seasonal normals. It just doesn't look there, even with these very large, high-pressure systems, patterns like that, which often give you frost.
It's really nice to have good weather conditions in here in the Midwest. They've been rough on and off throughout the season, but it's nice that it can happen. Tell me how they're starting out in South America now.
Well, in South America, it's been sort of a repetitive story. They had some pretty good showers. Let's do southern Brazil first,
okay,
where they're getting some of the wintering crops ready for harvest and get sowing the spring crops down there. They had some rain, which they needed, in southern Brazil. The rain is shifting northward and will be active in northern Brazil for the most part, except where they have a little wheat harvesting to do in some of the winter wheat areas of the far south. The weather's favorable for crops. Moisture's good and all of that. We've talked about Argentina for, most of the season, I think, on how dry it's been in parts of northern Argentina. And now, as they're getting ready to get their winter wheat matured, they've had some moisture stress. They even had a little cold weather drift up in there along with that, maybe had a little touch of frost here and there. I don't think that was a problem, but it's just that it's been tough, especially in Cordoba and Santa Fe provinces down there, where it's just been too dry to get the spring crops in and up very well. And the winter wheat farther south had a little struggle on dry weather getting mature.
Pete, thanks much.
My pleasure.
Pete Leavitt, meteorologist, joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. Stay with us for the Harvest Hour edition if you can. This is the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. In the next half hour or so, we'll be talking with Tom Baez. He's the National Farmers Union's 13th president and was elected to that at that organization's 104th anniversary convention, which was in 2006. We'll open up the phone lines for you in just a moment to talk with him. He's been with the organization since March of 1998 and previously served as vice president of government relations there. Prior to joining NFU, and these are the interesting things, I think, Baez served for nearly 5 years as the senior ag policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. He's a Democrat out of South Dakota. In addition, he worked for U.S. Representative Jim Johnson in Indiana and for nearly 5 years as a legislative assistant and legislative director for Jim Johnson. He was also a special assistant for agriculture to U.S. Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana, some famous names there, before moving to Washington, D.C. in 1987. Baez was a full-time grain and livestock farmer in Putnam and Morgan counties in west central Indiana, right in the middle of our coverage area. I suspect a few folks know his brother still there, who continue to farm, Mike and Jeff. Tom Baez, thanks for joining us here on the Closing Mark Report, the Harvest Hour edition today.
Oh, great to be with you, Todd.
Well, let's start off with this bailout plan in Washington, D.C. It has, well, a whole lot of sweetening in it, and some of it was sweetening for the U.S. agricultural industry. What do you think of it?
Well, you know, it's sort of a mixed bag. Number one, I think everyone is concerned about how extensive this credit crisis is going to become, and the financial crisis throughout America. You know, in agriculture, as you well know and your listeners know, it's a very capital-intensive industry, and it requires us to have affordable and available credit, even more so today than last year. As input costs keep going up, people have to borrow more. So what happens in the future is really important. I would add, most of the financial institutions that deal with agriculture are very strong. I mean, the ag sector of our economy is probably the strongest in the nation at this time. But if this continues and they don't get a handle on whatever's causing the problems, and that's part of the debate, whether or not what they do to address the situation, but if they don't, you know, it will eventually get down to rural America, and you know, higher interest rates and less available credit will be particularly difficult for farmers and ranchers.
Well, let me rephrase the question just a bit.
Uh-huh.
Do you think it's okay to get the legislation through that the Senate added in and some other things, to get it through the House, that they leave some of those amendments that do allow for the extension of some tax credits for ethanol and other biofuels? There's something in there for wind
energy.
Absolutely.
I think that's a good addition. You know, that we've tried to get that through in standalone legislation. And what you're really talking about are tax incentives to promote renewable energy that we're most concerned about. It also includes a fix on what they call the alternative minimum tax, which does hit a lot of people in your listening area if that kicks in as well. And this should have passed a long time ago, but it was one of those pieces of legislation that kind of become hostage to the political environment at the time. If not, the tax incentives for wind and solar energy projects will expire at the end of this year. You'll see investment into those type of operations dry up because of it. And, you know, if I've ever seen an opportunity any greater for rural America, it's all about producing energy from the farms, and not just ethanol and biodiesel, which we're all familiar with and in your listening area, but ever increasingly wind and solar, biomass, geothermal. All those things are going to be done in rural America, and that provides two opportunities. One, income for farmers, but also generates economic activities in rural communities. And if we're going to keep our rural communities vibrant economically, and opportunity for young people to stay in the rural communities and live and have jobs, then there couldn't be a better opportunity in at least my lifetime for doing that. You look at a small community with a $50 million ethanol plant built into it, and you see boards coming off storefronts, not the what we've seen for 50 years, and that's boards going up store on these small communities, and you lose your tax base, you lose your hospitals, you lose your schools, and pretty soon the community dries up.
Let's open our phone lines up and see if any of the listeners are wanting to ask you questions, too. This afternoon, we're talking with the president of the National Farmers Union. His name is Tom Baez. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do that. The number to call is 217-333-9455. That spells out W-I-L-L on those last four digits. That's 333-9455. We're in a 217 area code if you're outside of the listening area and listening on the web, or you'd like to call and talk to us toll-free, you can do that. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You opened up the food v. fuel debate just a bit. Let me take up some of what maybe we can talk about in terms of the economic health of farm communities. Are you fearful at all that if the ethanol plants, and maybe we should take up Iowa in particular, if they were to disappear as quickly as ethanol plants have in the past, in the 1980s, more than half of those plants that were put up, and I don't remember the number, I think about 65 of them, shuttered their doors in a year, what happens to Iowa, which appears to be really pretty dependent upon ethanol, and I suppose the rest of the national community at this point in agriculture?
Right. I do think it impacts the whole national farm economy, because what happened with the increase usage for ethanol is basically we got supply and demand back into balance. For years, we've been overproducing corn and soybeans and wheat, and those commodities, and hoping that we'd find a market for them, which often ended up being exports at below cost of production. Well, by adding value, and in this case energy, we've increased that demand, and it not only brought up corn prices, but it brought up prices across the board. As you started to see some shifts in production, farmers being able to actually get what they deserve as a profit from the marketplace. And no business can survive without it. So I think overall it's been a good thing. And if the ethanol industry contracts, we'll go back to an excessive amount of production that will depress prices. And if you look at the other side of the ledger, if you look at the inputs, which have skyrocketed because of energy, the real irony here is ethanol production, biodiesel production, is designed to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, which is ironically what's driving up all our imports, is high energy prices. So it does have a tremendous impact, Todd.
We have a phone call on line one this afternoon. Good afternoon, caller. You have a question for Tom Baez, the president of the National Farmers Union?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
With all these subsidies, just it seems like everybody wants to get subsidized for something. Who is supposed to pay for all this in the end? We've got Congress is out of control. Spending is out of control. I mean, if we tried everything we could do right now, we're in debt for probably generations.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. The last 6 or 8 years, it seems like we've been spending on everything. And we've had some rough spots that may not have been predictable, like 9/11 and the cost of it. But by and large, you have to get spending under control. In 2000, our economy was in good shape. We actually had a projected budget surplus. So it's all happened in the last 6 or 8 years. And like any entity, government has to get its spending under control. When you're talking about subsidies, and this bailout thing is really important, because how they do it, I mean, I think everyone understands something has to happen, but how they do it is the real trick. If you recall, in the mid-80s, we had a farm credit crisis in which they had to bail out the farm credit system, but it was structured in such a way that they had to pay every dime back plus interest, and they did. We also had the savings and loan crisis. and several crises. But you just don't give people a blank check, and that's what I think has a lot of people really concerned, is giving a blank check to bail out people that showed no responsibility and tried to make every dime they can. So when you talk about a $700 billion rescue plan, the devil's in the details. And, you know, I'd be the last person to say bail out Wall Street. I think, you know, what you really have to look at is the impact that it, as it comes downhill back to Main Street, back to rural America. And obviously we're dealing with a very serious crisis. I've never in my history out here seen Congress move as quick when the administration came to them with a problem in trying to deal with major legislation like that. So it is scary. And
it just makes me a little nervous when they do it so quick, actually. I mean, I didn't mean to get off of the ethanol stuff, but it just concerns me when it just seems like everybody wants subsidies. I mean, the ethanol,
right.
You know, I mean, they're getting, I mean, isn't it's crazy amounts of money, too, and it just.
Yeah. Well, there are no ethanol subsidies to farmers. And I hope everyone understands this. The tax credit, and it's called the blender's tax credit.
Okay.
Is the subsidy, and that goes to, ironically, the people that have been fighting ethanol. It goes to the oil industry, that, which refines ethanol into gasoline, or blends, it's a blender's tax credit, it blends ethanol with gasoline so you can burn it. So that really doesn't go to farmers, and I know that's tough because you even hear some people that know better start to say that, and if you add all that up, it's $4 billion, which is a small amount of the tax incentives that are given to oil companies to produce. So, you know, I think you have to look a little long-term on getting an industry started. Once it's up and running, I think you got to get rid of those subsidies, last forever.
Oh, yeah. Well, oil companies shouldn't be getting any tax credit, as far as I'm concerned.
I think they're doing pretty well, as far as I can see.
I was just curious about how much the farmers or the corn growers get, and just.
Well, on the farmers, and this is always interesting because the media often portrays it as a huge amount.
Yeah.
The recent farm bill, which is a 10-year score on the estimate of the price, was $300 billion, and oftentimes people make it sound like that all goes to farm subsidies. It doesn't. 73% of that $300 billion is for nutrition and hunger programs. And actually, the amount that goes for farm subsidies, which really are in place to kind of help when times are tough, people get by because you have so many variables that you can't control, like government, trade, and weather. But that the amount to farmers is 0.25%. 0.25% of the entire federal budget. We're talking about companies here in this bailout, individual companies that get far greater amounts than all farmers get, all 2 million farmers over a 10-year period.
Tom.
So, you know, it's like you have to put this stuff in perspective, and what's the goal here?
Tom, we'll come back in just 2 minutes, and we'll continue our conversation. Thanks for being on the line with us, and if you'll stay with us, we'll talk till right up till near 3 o'clock, okay?
Okay.
All right, thanks to our caller as well. If you'd like to call in, you can do that. It's toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's 222-WILL. Or if you're in the 217 area code, 333-9455. You're listening to the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. We're talking with Tom Baez. He's the president of the National Farmers Union.
Today's programs are made possible with support from the Champaign County Humane Society, promoting animal welfare since 1951. Pet adoptions are available from the Humane Society, a proud member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donation at work, on the web at cs-il.org.
Taking a look at what the weather forecast looks like for the two-state region from our own Ed Keiser. He says tonight in the north, mostly cloudy skies, a few scattered light showers. In central sections, partly to mostly cloudy. In the south, clear to partly cloudy. Lows generally between 40 and 45. Expect around 50 if you live near Lake Michigan. Tomorrow in northern Indiana and northeastern Illinois, Mostly cloudy, a few scattered sprinkles early, then partly sunny elsewhere, intervals of clouds and some sunshine. Highs tomorrow will range from 60 in the far north to 75 in the far southern part of Illinois. Temps should trend upward. High Saturday will range from the 60s in the north to the 70s, and then high Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday will be mostly in the 70s and the low 80s. Overnight lows will rise into the 50s next week. The warmer weather will aid, of course, crop maturation and harvesting. A few scattered showers possible on Sunday into Monday. Those will primarily be in northern Illinois and Indiana. Most central and southern locations will likely stay dry through Monday, and that should favor harvest operations.
WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. This is the Harvest Hour edition this afternoon. We're talking with the president of the National Farmers Union. He's been in that seat since 2006 when he was elected. Thanks for staying with us, Tom Baez. We appreciate you being with us this afternoon. I have a quick question for you. Do your brothers agree with most of what you have to say?
Do they agree with?
Well, they farm. I'm just wondering.
Ask,
you can say yes or no
you
and
would
move
have to
on.
Ask them. You know, I'm the middle of. I'm the middle brother.
Oh, you're the, well, so in that case,
I'm always
no.
I'm the one sort of trying to pull them together. How's that?
All right. That's good enough. It probably wasn't a fair question, but it popped into my mind.
No, ask them. They're both members of Farmers Union, so they haven't canceled their membership yet.
Well, there you go. I suppose they have their say in that case one way or the other, don't they? Well, tell me about the Farmers Union. What is it?
Well, the Farmers Union was founded 106 years ago in Point, Texas. And it was basically around the premise of 10 people got together. They were tired of getting below cost of production below what they paid to produce a crop in the marketplace of producing raw commodities. And they decided to start to add value. And they started by creating some co-ops. It has grown, obviously, from 10 people then. We have about 250,000 members, family memberships today. So every member of the family is a member, if one person is. And we're a general farm organization, which means we represent producers of all types from all different types of commodities all around the country. Our policy is all developed by our members. It's grassroots up, starts at the local level, moves to the state, and then is adopted by the national. And we don't represent other interests of agriculture. It's just generally family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities, and we're all funded by through that process. So there's never any doubt about who we represent.
Two topics I want to take up, and we started in on one of them, but I want to go more in depth in just a bit on credit. The other one is COOL, or country of origin labeling. Can you tell me about it?
Oh, yeah. The country of origin labeling is something that we've been advocating for a number of years. We got it into the 2002 Farm Bill. And then the people who don't want to label the products that come into this country or produced in this country from their origin kept getting delays after delay after delay in Congress to put off the implementation. So in this Farm Bill, we went back to work. We sat down with the big packers and processors that have always opposed labeling, and we worked out some agreements. And then when the rules were written, USDA gave them some flexibility on implementation, and basically, Todd, they took this little flexibility provision and thought it was an opening big enough to drive a combine with a 30-foot header through it. And what they're ending up doing on the beef side is they're not going to label U.S. product as U.S. product. They're going to put it into a category, which I call a NAFTA label, which is product of U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And 90%, 90 to 95%, depending on who you ask, of all the beef slaughtered that goes into the stores for muscle cuts, et cetera, is born, raised, and slaughtered in the United States. And we have no problems if other countries want to compete with us, but be proud enough to put your name on it. And let's tell the consumer, let's let the consumer differentiate or have the means to differentiate our high-quality products from the United States with our competition.
Hey, that comment on the 30-foot header only reminded me because of size about the 10-acre rule. I had a discussion with Doug Yoder, who's with the Illinois Farm Bureau. I had called and talked to him about baseball, actually, and traveling league for the boys.
White Sox?
No, traveling league for the young boys. He and I both have kids that are in traveling leagues. But I asked him about the 10-acre rule. I did not understand that of the farmers, I think in Illinois, there were 27,000 farms that were impacted by this. I thought it was really just the small farms, but it's the way the FSA has divided up farms in the past and that they need to be put back together. For instance, a 40-acre field, say, with my brothers, I have five brothers, there'd be six of us, so there would be each, if we each had a share in FSA, put it down all as smaller than 10 acres, of course, as separate farms, that would create a problem in the coming year. Do you think it's a good thing that that Congress managed to fix that at least for a year?
Out front on getting that change, because actually the Farm Bill had intended for USDA to implement it in such a manner that they aggregated those acreage.
Right.
And USDA, for whatever reason, you know, they've had, don't seem to be following the intent of the law and what Congress intended on implementing it. Also, the new acre program, the permanent disaster program, which is going to affect a lot of your viewers that got hit by floods, as well as country of origin labeling, and I don't understand why. So Congress had to step in on the 10-acre rule and the permanent disaster provision, for example, on it. It's called the SURE program at USDA. If your crop was flooded out this spring with all those excessive rains and you took the crop insurance indemnity on that crop, then you're ineligible to take the buy crop insurance if you replant it. And many people did replant, and then that got flooded out. And so that makes them ineligible for disaster assistance because USDA interpreted it that if you didn't have crop insurance on that second crop, which you were prevented from doing, you couldn't buy it, then you're ineligible for any assistance in the future. And that was never the intent of Congress. So they corrected those two this week. I know we're probably going to have corrections on country of origin labeling and also on the ACRE program, which is a new optional safety net for producers.
Okay, Tom, we're out of time. We're not going to get to the credit issue, but we covered it once. I thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Great. Thank you, Todd, for having me on.
Oh, you're certainly welcome. Tom Baez is the president of the National Farmers Union.